All right, if you have a Bible this morning, let's open it to John chapter 18. John 18 this morning. We're going to continue this series that we started last week called Under Pressure. John chapter 18. As you're finding your way in your Bible, let me just remind you that last week I sort of introduced this series because we had just come back from Alaska, and we had seen, and I told the story, I'd seen the incredible glaciers that they have up there in Alaska, these huge mountains of ice. And how one of the guides told us the story that these huge glaciers, as they sort of press down on the earth, literally cause the earth to not only break, but sometimes there's so much pressure that rocks, boulders, literally explode out of the ground. It's hard to imagine that kind of pressure. But that was something I was thinking about as we're going through this series, is you know, that's kind of a picture of our lives, isn't it? And sometimes in our lives, there's just this huge pressure sort of weighing down on us, this immense pressure. And you know what happens is, when you apply pressure in your life, something is going to come out of your life, right? And that's what we talked about last time, is that pressure reveals character. Around our house, around Thanksgiving and Christmas time, sometimes we'll have family come over. You probably do this. And we do something when we have a lot of people over at our house that we don't normally do, and that is we wash dishes by hand, right? Normally you put them in the dishwasher. And quite often I get challenged with the opportunity to do that. And sometimes we'll even have one of those little sponges out. And one of the things I noticed, if you're ever washing, you know, dishes, that once you get the sponge wet, you can't always tell just by looking at it if it's full of water or not. You have to reach over there, pick it up, and what? You have to squeeze it. And when you apply the pressure, you discover what it's made of, right? That's a picture also of our lives. And this morning, as we continue thinking about, you know, what it means to be under pressure, last week we talked about Jesus under pressure. Today we're going to talk about Peter under pressure. But all of our lives have these sort of pressure moments and things that we face. I heard about a guy that was the CFO of his company, and he had gotten a report, and he went to see the president of the company, and he said, "Mr. President, I've got bad news and I've got worse news." And the president said, "Well, what's the bad news?" He says, "Well, the report says we only have enough money for one more day of operations of our company." And the president said, "I can't imagine anything worse than that." He said, "Well, the worst news is that was yesterday's report, you know." Well, there are moments, yeah, thanks for getting that, you know. There are moments in life where you sort of weren't seeing this coming, and you're sort of pressed down. And this is where we're going to find Peter today. You know, Jesus was in the press, in the Garden of Gethsemane, it means the olive press. And he was praying, and he knew what he was about to experience. But today we're going to see Peter in the press, because what happens is that Peter watches as Jesus is arrested and bound, and they take him away, and Peter will follow. Look at verse 15, John 18, verse 15. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. They're following him. Jesus is bound. The Roman soldiers are carrying him away. Verse 15, because this disciple, this other disciple, was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. That's the courtyard out in front of his house. But Peter had to wait where? Outside at the door. Can you see that? Peter just standing there, he can't go in. The other disciple who was known to the high priest came back, and he spoke to the servant girl that was on duty there and brought Peter in. She asked him a question. She said to Peter, "You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you?" And he replied, "I am not." It was cold, and the servants' officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. By the way, this is the springtime in Jerusalem, and I checked the other day, the lows in Jerusalem at this time of the year are in the 40s. It could be colder, the wind could be blowing. They're in the higher elevation of Jerusalem, which is already pretty high up. They're in that part of the city that's in the higher area. So it may have been in the 40s, may have been colder. It was cold, it says, verse 18, and the servants and officials stood around the fire they had to keep warm. Peter was standing with him, warming himself. So you see that. Now look what happens in verse 19. Meanwhile, All of a sudden, the scene changes, doesn't it? The high priest questioned Jesus. So now we're finding out what's happening to Jesus. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. "I have spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews came together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" Smack, he demanded. "If I said something wrong," Jesus replied, "testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why do you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now look what it says in verse 25. Meanwhile, scene changes. Simon Peter was still standing there warming himself. And so they asked him, "You aren't one of his disciples too, are you?" And he denied it, saying, "I'm not." One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him. "Didn't I see you with him in the garden?" And again Peter denied it. And at that moment, a rooster began to crow. John has done something really deliberately as he's telling the story. He's done something very creative. He's chosen to tell the story as if there are three different scenes that we need to know to understand what's happening here. So let's look at what happens in scene one. Peter is outside, right? He's outside the gate of the courtyard. He can't go in until another disciple comes, it says, and that disciple then helps him to get in. Now, the question is, who is it? Who is this other disciple that's not mentioned? And you could kind of think, well, I don't know who else was there. Maybe it was Judas, somebody said, you know? Maybe Judas came over there and got him, but we know Judas wouldn't do that. What was Judas doing? He was counting his money at this point, right? He wasn't interested in helping Peter get in. It wasn't Judas. Who is this other disciple? Well, the answer is kind of given to us in the Gospel of John. You see, throughout this part of John's Gospel, there is a reference to one of Jesus' disciples, but we're never told his name. It'll say over and over again, "He is the disciple Jesus loved." Or it'll say, "He's the other disciple," but it won't tell us who it is. And according to our tradition, we know exactly who it was. It was John, the author of this Gospel, John the son of Zebedee. You say, well, how do we know that? Well, if you go all the way to the end of John's Gospel, there's a scene. Once again, Peter's there, and this beloved other disciple is there. I want to read to you that scene in John 21, 20. It's on your outline. We can put it up on the screen. It says, "Peter turned, and he saw the disciple whom Jesus loved," the so-called beloved disciple, "was following them. And this was the one who had leaned against Jesus at the supper and who had said, 'Lord, who's going to betray you?'" Now fast forward a little bit, and then he says this, "This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who," what? "Wrote them down." The disciple that wrote this gospel is the beloved disciple, and by history and by other accounts, we know this is John. So that's who the other disciple is. And so he comes, and he gets Peter, and he comes up to the gate, and he says to the lady at the gate, "Let us in." Now how does he get in? Partly he gets in because John lets him in. But what else does he have to do? Because he stopped right there. And the porter, the servant girl at the gate, asks him a question. And he has to lie. Part of the way he gets in is by telling a lie. She asks him, "Are you one of his disciples?" And Peter says what? "No." And this becomes the first of his denials. Now, I want to tell you something you can't tell in English. In Greek, when you ask a question, in Greek, there's a way you ask a question in which you expect the answer to be yes or no. And when she asks this question to Peter in Greek, she assumes that he's not one of his disciples. So she's sort of asking the question, "You're not really one of his disciples, are you?" She doesn't think that he is. And he says, "I'm not." Now, we sometimes give Peter a hard time right here, don't we? We sometimes say, man, Peter denied Jesus. But let's be honest. At this point, all he's trying to do is to get in. He's not making any bold-faced denials of Jesus. He's just trying to get inside. By the way, this is not the only time Peter gets left outside at a gate. There's another time in the Bible when this happens. Did you know that in the book of Acts? Acts chapter 12, it's one of those great stories. This time Peter's in prison. In the morning, he's going to be handed over for trial and probably beheaded like James was. In the middle of the night, an angel comes and says, stand up, take the chains off of you. And Peter starts following this angel through the gates of the Antonia fortress where he was held, and all of the Roman guards are there, and they don't even notice or say anything, and he walks all the way out into the street, and then the angel disappears, and then he walks to the streets of Upper Jerusalem to a home not far from this home that's here, and he comes up to an outer gate and a door, and he knocks on the door, and a servant girl comes to the door, and inside is the praying early church praying for the release of Peter. And the servant girl recognizes Peter at the door, and she runs to the church praying and says, hey, Peter's at the door. And they say, it can't be Peter. He's in prison. It must be his ghost. And when they go and they open the door, Peter is standing there at the door. It's one of those great stories. In fact, this is what's happening here. Peter is on the outside. Now, John also wants us to know what happens with Jesus on the inside. That's the second part of the story in verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest is questioning him. Now, Jesus has been brought to the home of a man named Annas. And you may have been reading that or hearing me read that a moment ago, and you thought, well, who is this? Why is he at Annas' house? Who is this guy? Well, Annas is actually the former high priest. Annas was high priest for a long time until the Romans said, you're not going to be high priest anymore. And they made Annas' son-in-law, Caiaphas, the high priest. But Annas was still running the show. He was really the de facto leader. And so they brought him to Annas first. And Annas begins to ask Jesus some questions. Now, we don't have a full transcript of this conversation. It would have really been interesting to hear all the back and forth. But we do know what Annas was trying to do based on Jesus' response to Annas. Jesus will say to him, I didn't do anything in secret. I taught openly. I taught in synagogues, and I taught in the temple courts. Based on Jesus' reaction, what's Annas trying to get him to do? Well, he's trying to get him to admit that he's been conspiring secretly against the Jewish authorities. And if he can pin that on him, then he can entrap him in the charge of blasphemy. That's what Annas is trying to do in this moment. He is trying to entrap Jesus in the charge of blasphemy, which in the Old Testament, according to the law, would be punishable by what? Death, because he wants to kill him. In fact, here's one of the many times in the Old Testament it refers to this blasphemy charge. Exodus 22, 28 says, do not blaspheme God. We know that one. But look what else it says. Or curse the ruler of your people. They're trying to pin that on him. Jesus answers, and then it says in John's gospel that somebody comes up and they strike him, they slap him. Now, Matthew's gospel tells us that there was more happening. In Matthew 26, 27, it says that they spit in his face. They struck him with their fists, and others slapped him. Picture Jesus before Annas. He's just been bound, having been in the Garden of Gethsemane where he was praying. He'd eaten that Last Supper, you know, before that. They bound him, then they began one by one striking him in the face. You can just imagine the red marks on his face, the spittle draining down from his face where people have been spitting on him, the where they've punched him. You can imagine his eyes are swollen, his nose is running with blood, his cheeks, his lip cracked, blood draining from his teeth. You can just picture Jesus in this moment and realize the cruelty and brutality that they treated Jesus with. But you know, I was thinking about this week, we do that with Jesus in our world today. Maybe not with our fists, maybe not with our spit, but Jesus is everybody's punching bag. Everybody likes to make fun of Jesus, to criticize Jesus. Peter's on the outside, Jesus is on the inside. But here's the other thing I want you to see in this story, is where you and I step in. Because we're in the story too. Where are we? We are beside. We're beside the fire. When we were kids, growing up I grew up in out in East Texas, and in wintertime, my dad did not believe in turning on the heater. We chopped up wood, and we had a little open fireplace. And so we'd get out there, and we'd cut up, and the first thing you'd do is get up in the morning, and you'd make a big fire. And one of the things I love to do, still love to do, is just to sit there and watch a fire as it burns. It's mesmerizing, isn't it? You can see the flames dancing around, and you can almost see things inside the fire. I want us just right now to imagine that we're right there with Peter and everybody gathered around that fire. As we look into the fire, we begin to see there's some people in the fire. Who's in the fire? Number one, Jesus, right? While all this is happening, Jesus is inside being brutalized. Jesus is being falsely accused. Jesus is about to be handed over to be crucified. When we were in Israel, one of the things that they do is they show you this house, which archaeologists believe to be the house where much of this took place. And then they walk you down below the house into where the stone steps have been carved out. And underneath the house, there are these antechambers, these rooms, which were obviously some kind of prison cells. And on the walls, there's little pieces of metal where chains were attached and people were held there. And they say this might have been where Jesus was being held. You know, a lot of us know this story so well, we forget that the early Christians had no idea that the Messiah was going to have to go through all this. They had no idea. The Jewish people didn't know that the Messiah was going to have to suffer and die. In fact, when Paul became a Christian, he would go around to synagogues and he would tell the Jews, he'd say, listen, this is what the Scriptures says was supposed to happen. We have a record of one of Paul's first sermons. It's found in Acts chapter 17. I want to read to you what Paul says. As was his custom, Acts 17:2, he went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead. He had to explain it to them because they didn't know that it was God's plan for the Messiah to suffer and die. And then Paul says this, this Jesus I'm proclaiming to you is the Messiah. This Jesus who was spit on and punched and slapped and killed, he's the Messiah. Jesus is in the fire. Go back to the fire. You keep looking into it. Who else do we see there? And that's Peter. Peter is in the fire. Peter is being scrutinized in this moment. And for the second time, somebody by the fire says, Hey, weren't you one of those guys in the garden? No, not me. And then a third person looks at him and says, hey, and it's one of the relatives of Malchus, the high priest's servant that he cut off his ear. Now, you would think that if someone cut your ear off, you might remember what they look like. You know, I mean, it may have been not a lot of light, torch light. I think I'd remember the person who chopped my ear off. Hey, you're the guy. You're the guy. And Peter denies it for the third time and the rooster crows. Hey, listen, the first time Peter denied Jesus, he was just trying to get inside the court, in the outer court. He was just trying to get inside to see what was happening to Jesus. He was just trying to get inside because he was following Jesus. But now, it's different. He's not trying to get in. Peter is now trying to get out. He just wants to get out alive. Before, he was following Jesus, but now he's just trying to save his skin. Now he's denying Jesus, not because he's following him, but because he just wants to preserve his own life. He sees what's happening to Jesus, and he doesn't want that to happen to him. Now we know that Peter denied Jesus three times, but we also know the rest of the story, right? That he repented of that, and Jesus restored him, and then he would go on to become one of the greatest spokespersons for Jesus ever in Christianity. And that later in his life, Peter would write a letter, we call it 1 Peter, to Christians who were also in the fire, Christians who were suffering. And he wrote this in his letter, 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7. In all of this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. The word trial, parasmos in Greek, means fiery ordeals. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. You and I like Peter, might be going through a fiery ordeal. We might be going through a trial, he says, but it has a purpose. And that purpose is to refine our faith, which is finally the last person in the fire, right? We're just looking into the fire, and who do we see? This morning, I see a reflection of me. Maybe you do too. Maybe you see yourself right now in the midst of your life this morning that you also are in the fire. And the proven genuineness of your faith is also being tested. The book of Proverbs often uses the analogy of fire and faith. In Proverbs 17:3, it says, "The crucible is for silver." You know, they take silver and they put it in that crucible and they heat it up. "The furnace is for gold." You know, when you mine gold or when you pan gold, we got to do that in Alaska. That's not all they do to it. Then they put it into a fire and they dissolve the impurities. The crucible is for silver. The furnace is for the gold. But the Lord tests the heart. God tests our lives. He tests our character in the fiery ordeals of life. Listen, we may deny Jesus. We may deny him with our words like Peter did. We may deny him with our actions. But we might also deny him in a more or less obvious way through our lifestyle. The author of the Ragamuffin Gospel, Bruce Manning, wrote these words, "The greatest single cause of atheism in the world today is Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips and they walk out the door and they deny him by their lifestyle. This is what an unbelieving world simply finds unbelievable." You know, if you were to go all over the earth today and try to find high-pressure places, you would discover that the place with the most pressure is actually below the ocean, deep into underneath the ocean. And do you know that throughout all of human history, nobody knew what was down there? In the early part of the 1900s, scientists and explorers began, out of a sense of curiosity, to wonder, hey, what's below the surface? And they began to explore the ocean depths, but you can't go down very far because the pressure is so intense, it will crush you, destroy anything that you put down there. And so the 1930s, a group of scientists began working on something they called the bathysphere. It's this tiny little sphere made of this thick metal, thick steel, with a tiny little glass window in it, and you would crawl inside of it, and they would lower you by a cable into the ocean. The first time they tried it, it failed, which I don't know about you. I don't know if I'd want to crawl into that thing. But then they took it a little bit further, and they worked out a few kinks, and finally they began to do deep sea exploration in this little bathysphere. And they got it to a record depth of 3,000 feet beneath the surface. Now, down there, the pressure is so great. The scientists were asked the question, hey, aren't you afraid that if you get down there, water might leak in there and you'll drown? The scientists said, we would never drown. It's impossible. He said, because we would die first before we'd ever drown. He said, because if even a single droplet of water was to escape through, there's so much pressure that it would enter into the bathysphere at such an incredible velocity, like the speed of a bullet, that it would literally hit your body and eviscerate you. When you think about the pressure at 3,000 feet beneath, incredible pressure. But inside of that bathysphere, there was a glass window. And what these scientists would do is they would look through that glass window, and out of it, they would see all these sea creatures. Fish. Now, wait a minute. How come these scientists had to build this metal chamber to surround them to go down there, and here are all these supple fish freely just floating around like it's no big deal? They don't have any big armor around them keeping them safe. How are they able to withstand the pressure? And the answer is that the fish that live at that depth don't create something around them. Their strength doesn't come from the outside, but it comes from the inside. How they're able to live under such pressure is because of what they're made of. It's because of their character. It's because of who they are. When we were in Alaska, we saw the calving of the glaciers when these ice will, you know, break off and it'll land in the ocean. And you'll see these little icebergs and the surface currents and the wind just kind of blow them around. But in other parts of the ocean, there are these huge icebergs, some of them thousands of miles in their circumference. Those icebergs, they don't get blown around by surface winds or surface currents. They're driven by deep ocean currents. And I think that's also an analogy of our lives. You know, there's some people, when pressure comes, the littlest bit of wind blows them here, they start going here. When the little bit of pressure in life starts pushing them this direction, they're just driven by every little wind, every little surface current of life just drives them back and forth. But there are other people whose faith and trust in Christ runs so deep that their lives are driven by a deeper current, by a stronger impulse than just the casual pressures of life. How do you survive under pressure? It starts with a deep character, a deep commitment, a deep relationship with Jesus Christ.